Well, we start a series in the prophecy of Daniel this morning. Daniel, one of the major prophets in the Old Testament. The series title is God's Kingdom Above All Else. And today we will, with God's help, look at chapter 1. The entirety of it, verses 1 through 21. And as you're turning there, I was thinking about one of those times that I engaged in a trip, a whitewater rafting trip, and other times that I've gone on a canoe trip with people, and you've maybe been in that sort of experience where you're in the boat, or maybe, because your son has tipped you over, been, you know, out of the boat, but you feel the current of the river. You've been in that sort of situation? Well, I remember this one particular time we were whitewater rafting, and there's a guide in the boat, and one tragic year the guide wasn't in the boat but was in a kayak next to us and left the steering to us. But at certain points of the trip, you're to sort of pull over and get out, right? Whether it be for lunch or just to maybe appreciate some scenery or something at that point. And I remember this one particular time we overshot where we were supposed to land. Okay? Ever been in that situation? Where, you know, you're supposed to just kind of, you know, paddle hard into right here, and this is the landing area, and you'll be able to, you know, easily get out of the boat, except for the fact that we didn't turn hard enough and we missed. And now, of course, we were faced with the obstacle, the hard work of trying to paddle against the current to get back to where we were supposed to be. Ever been in that position? Raise your hand if you've ever had anything like that, okay? All right, a fair number of you. And it seems like in that kind of a situation, everything's working against you. The current, certainly, right? If you've ever had an appreciation for the force of nature, just stand in a river that's running against you, right? And you know, you're trying to get a foothold as maybe you're outside the boat and the rocks are slippery, and maybe step on a log that's been submerged for a long time and it's real slick. But if you're in the boat, you're trying to paddle, and perhaps the riverbed is shallow at that point, and you can't even get a full, you know, stroke in, so your paddle's hitting the sand on the bottom, and it seems like everything's against you. And in a lot of ways, that's what it's like to live as a Christian in this world. It seems like everything is against us. World powers, everyday people, curriculum in school, advertising, neighbors, friends, laws that are passed. It seems like everything is working against us to simply live out our Christian faith. That's what it's like to live as one of God's people in this sin-cursed, God-hating world. And that's what the book of Daniel's all about. Daniel knew this struggle full well and teaches us so much about how we ought to live in this world as one of God's people distinct. So before we begin, before we read the text, I just want to sort of set the historical stage for us. Okay, because this book is written about a particular time period, a particular snapshot in Israel's history. But leading up to that, we have to sort of backtrack and say, how did we get here? Well, you surely know that King Solomon reigned over a united kingdom of Israel, and the boundaries of which were expanded. And the success and wealth and fame of the kingdom of Israel was at its pinnacle. But alas, after his death, Israel split into two kingdoms. the 10 northern tribes being simply referred to as Israel, and the 2 southern tribes called for the most prominent of the 2, Judah. In 722 BC, the northern kingdom of Israel was defeated by the Assyrians. Remember the Assyrians, we just had sermons in the book of Jonah, right? And Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh, the capital city of the Assyrians, right? Jonah came before the 722 BC. But alas, on that date, the Assyrians moved into the northern kingdom of Israel and carried them all away into exile because of their unfaithfulness to God. God used Assyria as his judging agent. And that kingdom would never be restored. The northern kingdom would never, you know, come back and be gathered again. And while Judah was spared from the Assyrians, God's wrath for her disobedience would not be held back forever. The Assyrian Empire was a great world power, but they would soon come to be replaced by the Babylonians in 612 BC. So, you know, sort of in your mind, think about a timeline that we're walking through now. Now we're at 612 BC. The Babylonians now come to power. And just a few years thereafter, God would use them to punish Judah for worshiping other gods. Though the godly king Josiah would be spared, the fall of the southern kingdom was predicted while he was on the throne. This is what we read in 2 Chronicles 34, 24 and 25. Listen. Behold, I will bring disaster upon this place and upon its inhabitants, all the curses that are written in the book that was read before the king of Judah, because they have forsaken me and have made offerings to other gods that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore, my wrath will be poured out on this place and will not be quenched. That was the judgment of the southern kingdom that was predicted in Josiah's day. And it came, sure enough. Babylon's defeat of Jerusalem actually came in 3 different waves. First, in 605 BC, there was an initial capturing of the king and those in influential families. And this is likely when Daniel and his 3 friends were taken in this first sort of wave of Babylon coming and establishing their influence and rule over the southern kingdom. However, as we'll see as we progress through the book of Daniel, this book covers actually a large sweep of Judah's history, including their mass deportation that would come, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 587 BC, and their 70 years in exile in Babylon. So that brings us to the book. That brings us to chapter 1, as we would look at Daniel chapter 1, and this is the theme that emerges, friends, as we would consider this chapter. In bringing about his certain plans for human history, God overrules earthly powers by honoring his people's refusal to compromise their faith. Now, that's on your little bulletin handout. I know that's a long sentence. I'm going to read it one more time. This is the theme that emerges out of chapter 1. In bringing about his certain plans for human history, God overrules earthly powers by honoring his people's refusal to compromise their faith. And that's what we see as we open Daniel chapter 1. Follow along with me as we would read. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king?" Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Well, I think Daniel knows something about living in a culture that is against his upbringing. His upbringing among God's people. First thing we see in verses 1 through 7 is, first thing that we observe is the powerful pressure that's placed upon God's people. The first part of our text demonstrates how the world puts great demands on God's people to conform to its godless ways. Let us first look at the historical setting which Daniel grounds these events within. Verses 1 and into the first part of 2, hear the words again. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar. Now, Judah's susceptibility to worldly powers had actually been shown years earlier, before this besieging, before Nebuchadnezzar came and took the city. Egypt had already been dictating political power within Israel. They had decided, in fact, who would sit on Judah's throne. After Josiah had died, his son Jehoahaz assumed the throne, but he only reigned for about 3 months until Egypt took him off the throne and replaced him with one of his brothers that would be more suitable to Egypt's interests. That's how Jehoiakim came to be king when the Babylonians invaded Jerusalem. You see that move there? So the king on the throne when the Babylonians came wasn't the one that was supposed to be the king. It was the king that Egypt put on the throne. But Daniel's description about what happens in this text was that things had now grown markedly worse. It wasn't simply Egypt sort of, you know, letting things happen in Israel and the worship and the culture of those people continue, but perhaps with a different leader now. 2 Chronicles 36:6 records that Nebuchadnezzar bound Jehoiakim in chains and took him to Babylon. Others were taken into exile as well. We see that in verse 3. The king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility. Why? Those were the people that might rise up against Nebuchadnezzar, that might lead a rebellion against their new overseer. And they, this idea of being exported out of their land, exiled, carried away to a foreign land to take them away from the people. Things had grown, as I said, markedly worse. Second, consider the profound effect that this exile would have had on God's people. We have to step in the shoes of the original readers here, the ones that were exiled. They would have been the first people to read this account. And consider the effect, friends, on God's people being in exile. Consider the effect on the people. Daniel's original readers would have been living in Babylon, dispossessed of the promised land, kept from the temple to live as a conquered people. The opening verses of chapter 1 would have made an immediate emotional connection with the readers, remembering that they had been taken from the promised land. They were supposed to be a people for God's own possession, not the possession of a foreign king. God was supposed to be their deliverer and protector. These are the things that are going on in those original readers. We can't miss this. We can't simply stand off afar and think about this as just some sort of interesting historical, you know, accounting. The Lord had delivered God's people from the might of the Egyptians in the Exodus. He had exposed the impotency of so-called pagan gods. Remember back when the Philistines had captured the ark and brought it into Philistia? And God had toppled their God in the temple, in their temple, and cursed the people with tumors. And God had railed against the northern kingdom through the prophet Amos for not worshiping in Jerusalem. These are all the things that are in the backdrop of the psyche of this now conquered people of God. All of those rescues, all of those deliverances, all of those blessings, all of those inheritances had now been undone. Nebuchadnezzar had seemingly bested the Lord. Notice the Babylonian king appears as the major character in this text. His name is only mentioned twice, once in verse 1 and a second time in verse 18, but he's referenced as the king some 15 times. 15 times in only 21 verses here. Over and over again, the reader hears the king, the king, the king, the king running through this text. Additionally, we read of his God in verse 2, and his officials in verse 3, and his palace in verse 4, and his food and wine in verse 5, and his realm or his kingdom in verse 20. You can almost feel the dread of the conquered Israelites reading this account, being reminded that they had been stolen from the land God had promised them and their forefathers as an inheritance forever. Even objects reserved for worship in the Lord's temple had been carried away and were now housed in the house of Nebuchadnezzar's God. In verse 2, we read that. Worse still was the powerful pressure the king had exerted on God's people for them to conform to the Babylonian way of life. So bad enough that they had been ripped out of the promised land. Bad enough that they had been kept now from worshiping in the place that they were to worship God. Worse than some of even the holy elements of worship being taken from the temple. Worse than them being taken out of their culture. Now there was this great pressure for God's people to live as Babylonians. To live the king's way of life. He was trying to obliterate their former identity as God's people. It's systematic in this text. It's hinted at in Daniel's usage of the phrase, the land of Shinar in verse 2. Did you see that? There's no explanation. It doesn't come up again. This was the ancient name for Babylon. Interesting, if you do a search for where that comes up in the Bible, the first time it comes up is way back in Genesis chapter 11. There was a plain of Shinar, and in that place, men built a tower known as the Tower of Babel. The reason they built that tower, of course, was to make a name for themselves with no association of God. To make a great name for themselves, to come up with an identity that had nothing to do with their Creator. And it's here that we see the first hinting of the king's plan. Nebuchadnezzar was trying to force the people of God to forget that they were the people of God. This is seen through all of the things he commanded concerning them. That's another thing, another sort of, you know, repetition we hear through the text, him ordering and commanding and appointing. Initially, the king commanded his chief eunuch to bring these influential and intelligent young men to be trained in the literature and language of the Chaldeans so they could later serve in the king's court. We read of that in verse 4. Now, there's two things that we have to consider about this first order, this first command of the king. First, the best and the brightest of Judah were being ordered to learn how to be a Babylonian for 3 years, it says in verse 5. Their indoctrination would be for 3 years. They would be immersed into Babylonian culture and language and literature and customs. Verse 6 identifies some of those taken. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. It's interesting that their tribe is noted here. They are identified as men of that particular tribe. But the king's goal was for them not to be identified with any tribe of Israel. Second, these men were not simply being asked to learn to speak another language. This wasn't just like taking French class. But to learn the language and literature of the Chaldeans had a particular evil connotation to it. One commentator, Bob File, notes this for us. Chaldeans refers particularly to the sages or soothsayers who were an important group in advising the king. Much of their study would involve magic, sorcery, divination, and astrology. These things, of course, were forbidden in the law of God. We know this to be true because at the end, when the king sizes up Daniel and his friends, it says that he considers them 10 times better than who? All of his magicians, all of his sages. You see, because they had been studying the literature and the culture of those people. Next, the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and the wine that he drank. In verse 5, these young men were to forget their customary Jewish diet. They were to educate their palate to the fares of Babylonia. They were to regularly now dine from the king's table. And so be associated with him. Finally, the young Judeans would even be given new Babylonian names. Did you see that in verse 7? Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. Now, we don't have time to go into all of the meanings of these names, but let me read one commentator that explains one of them. The name Daniel means Elohim is my judge. Elohim is one of the Hebrew names for God, of course. The name Belteshazzar, by contrast, means may Bel protect his life. Bel being one of the gods of Babylon. So you can see that this renaming, there was a motive behind it. This was yet another step, another pressure of the Babylonians to stamp out God's people's identity. It caused them to conform to the world's way of living and believing. We see in this first part of the story an enduring truth. This godless world will use its power to pressure God's people to conform to its beliefs, to yield to its practices, and even to take up its identity. This was true in Daniel's day, and it's true today. I mean, even with the shooting on Central Michigan's campus, I'm so glad Fisher's here and my niece is okay. She goes to CMU as well. And even the world would tell us how to think about that, how to think about that tragedy. There's no explanation of sin in this world. There's no explanation of a need for a savior when a calamity like this happens, right? It's all about what regulations will put in place. It's all about blamesmanship among political parties and things like this. The world uses all of its pressures to try to push God's people to think the way the world thinks. I mean, you could be a Christian today, but be the kind of Christian that doesn't see things as black and white, right? You can believe in the God of the Bible, but be open to other gods and other religious traditions. Embrace all beliefs. You can believe in Jesus dying for sinners, but just don't brand anything the world does as sin. I mean, isn't the world we live in today trying to shape you into the kind of person who views things the way they view it? Seeing killing an unborn child as a mere medical procedure? Questionable business ethics as the way of profit? Sexual immorality as healthy recreation and false religions as meaningful cultural exchanges? This is the way the world wants us to see these things. I mean, I already feel in my own self, right, much less in the church family, my lack of indignation at homosexuality. Because it's in every movie, it's in every TV show, it's in every now, I mean, even Archie Andrews, right, and Jughead, right? Now one of them is a homosexual in today's version of that comic. And it's the world trying to influence and use all of its pressure to shape us to think and behave as the world does. But friends, remember that this world is under satanic influence. And those Satan controls are exerting immense pressure for Christians to be embarrassed about what the Bible teaches, to compromise God's call to remain undefiled in this world, to conform to its godless ways. The world wants God's people to do more than be silent. The world wants us to admit that our stances on sin, false religions, homosexuality, and the like are both ignorant and racist. Don't you feel the pressure to succumb, to put your head down and conform to the way of the world today? mean, even within the workplace, right? We feel the pressure to just shut up and be invisible, and nobody wants to know what you think about right and wrong. Certainly Daniel and his friends felt that pressure. And it's so relevant to us today. This is a message we need to hear. If we are going to be a distinct people, if we are going to be a holy nation, right? If we are going to be God's priesthood in this world, we need this message today. As we move forward in our story, we see in verses 8 through 14, Daniel's example, the righteous resistance of Daniel and his friends. Over against the massive onslaught of royal edicts and Babylonian brainwashing, Daniel refused to yield to defilement. He was resolved to take his stand against the intense forces of worldly compromise. Look at verse 8. Aren't you glad for that that word of contrast, but? After all of that pressure, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Most believe Daniel was a teenager at this point. The commentaries I read posit that he was probably between 13 and 16 in particular. And they factor that because he would be serving into his 80s by the end of this chapter when Cyrus reaches the throne. So this was a young teenage Daniel that resolved not to defile himself. Now consider a few things about this point. Young people are being pressured to compromise what they believe. Young people are being pressured to compromise what they believe. Young people are being pressured to compromise what they believe. The world wants to capture the next generation. Satan wants to rip our young people out of the faith. Erase all of the Bible teaching, all of the worship services that they have experienced, all of the teachings and discipleship of their parents. The world wants to pressure young people to compromise what they believe. That's the first point. Second, young people are precious members of God's family, and He uses them in significant ways. Young people are treasured members of God's family, and He has significant plans for them in His kingdom. Thirdly, despite the fact that Daniel was a youth, despite the fact that he had no influence in the land of Shinar, despite the fact that he was powerless, God gives us this example of how to have courageous faith in the face of wicked opposition. This is how God shapes His kingdom. When people that have no worldly power stand up because they believe in the God whose kingdom is above all other kingdoms. And this is the story of Daniel. This is the story of this one young teenager that stood up and said, I will not succumb to worldly pressure. I won't be defiled. Now, what was the godless ways of the world against which Daniel was taking this stand? It could have been a violation of dietary standards in the Mosaic law. Or if you remember back to my Proverbs 9 sermon a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly asking the simple to come and do what? To dine with them. And we talked about that custom of coming in and dining with somebody, right? Dining at their table symbolized a relationship, somewhat of an intimate relationship. And so it could have been simply that the eating of the king's food and the drinking of the king's wine was seen to be an identification with the king, an implied family relationship that would come from dining at his table. However, the text doesn't make it clear for us exactly what the objection was. But what it does say is that Daniel saw it to be a defilement. That is, a practice that would make him unfit to worship God. And this is where he drew the line. He determined to fear God rather than even this great king. Notice how Daniel lived out his conviction. I think what we see a lot of today as examples of how the Christian ought to live in the world is to be rude to those that have different viewpoints. That is, to sue our way to get our rights from the world, and to speak with a loud microphone every chance we get, and to degrade those that are in leadership above us. But that's not the example we get here about Daniel living out his conviction. We don't see him as combative, but respectful. We don't see him as riotous, but rather humble. Look at verse 8 here, the second half. He asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Boy, that's a soft tone, isn't it? That feels a little bit like Peter's exhortation to always be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within us, yet with gentleness and respect. This is always the calling for God's people. Not to live like the world as we say we believe differently, but to live in humble trust of God as we speak for Him. And that's what we see in Daniel in verse 8. He asked if he would be allowed to not defile himself. That's just even an awkward sentence to say. Allow me to maybe step on a couple of toes and try to make an application of this point. Now, I have to, set up some caveats here, okay? There are people that are called by necessity to work on a Sunday morning. There are police officers on duty. There are surgeons attending to people in dire health needs. There are firefighters just up the street. There are paramedics. There are lots of people that are working on Sunday morning, and lots of God's people working on Sunday morning. But allow me to just think through how we might, as somebody asked to work in one of those non-essential, I'll call it, positions, how we might apply this example of Daniel. I wonder if God's people would be respectful and humble and go to their employers and say something like this: worshiping God is the most important thing in my life. And I see that you're scheduling me on Sunday morning, and I'm called upon to go to my church. The Bible calls me to do that, and I want to do that, to gather with God's people to worship Him. It's really important to me. And I wondered if you would consider scheduling me in such a way so that this hour and a half block might be freed up for me to do that. I wonder what the result might be. No doubt there would be some bosses that would say, hey, this is the schedule. If you want this job, you'll show up at 8:30 on Sunday morning or whatever, right? But I wonder if some might hear that respectful request and grant it. I just wonder. I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, how would this strike me? How can I live out this application? Consider it. Consider maybe some other application that I'm not coming up with here. But consider this, how Daniel did this. Perhaps there's some practice in your school that violates your conscience. I wonder if you approached a teacher or a counselor or a principal and respectfully and humbly asked that you be allowed to not participate in this event because it violates your conscience. I wonder what the result might be. Notice that the text says nothing of what Daniel expected would happen. You see that? There's no description here of Daniel was so sure, right, that things were going to go his way, that's why he took his stand. We don't read that. He had no guarantee that his faithfulness would not bring him harsh punishment and even perhaps death at his refusal to obey the king. You know, let's make no mistake about it. Allegiance to God is inherently risky in this world. In fact, it usually puts you squarely in harm's way. Recall Jesus' words in John 15. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. So let's not mince words here. Our goal is not simply to navigate, a cozy life, a comfortable life. We're called upon to stand for our trust in God. And sometimes, oftentimes, that puts us in danger. The chief of the eunuchs could have made real trouble for Daniel, but God had other plans. Look at verse 9. God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. God doesn't always cause those in power over us to be gracious to us when we take our stands for Him. Sometimes we are ridiculed or maligned or suffer more harsh persecution even. But sometimes He moves in the hearts of unbelievers to our amazement for them to treat us favorably. Now, we have to be careful when those times occur that we don't sort of pat ourselves on the back and say, boy, I really did a good job there. I really represented God well there. And if I'll just behave in that way, my natural charisma and charm, I'll win people. Now, we've got to be careful, friends, not to steal God's glory in those situations. We never earned that favor. It is rather a working of divine grace. So God gets all the praise in those circumstances. Though the chief of the eunuchs was favorably disposed toward Daniel, nevertheless, his fear of the king kept him from granting Daniel's request. We saw that in verse 10. However, Daniel's resolve is not so easily snuffed out here. Did you see that? It requires a little bit of a careful reading, but he pivots to somebody else when that happens. He turns to, in verse 11, the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel. So catch the story now. Daniel goes to the chief of the eunuchs, right? And that man is favorably disposed to him. He doesn't, sort of haul him off for punishment at the request. But nevertheless, his fear of the king's, wrath keeps him from agreeing to it. So what does Daniel do? He pivots to the one that this chief of eunuch had placed immediately over him to dispense the food and asked him. You see that? I wonder if we would be that creative and persistent. His approach is consistent with what he believes. It's consistent with his resolution not to be defiled. He displays deference to the steward. Again, we see it in this instance, referring to himself as a servant, both in verses 12 and 13, and provides him, when he objects, provides him with a reasonable way to say yes. Look at verse 13. Let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you and dealt with your servants according to what you see. Now, this is him really standing out on faith here, right? Because I'm here to tell you that since my operation, my doctor told me I cannot have sugar, okay? And so I'm eating things that, quite frankly, I don't like. I'm eating the sort of things that don't make somebody fat. Okay? And it would be like me saying, hey, I'm just going to keep eating these vegetables and you're going to see me plump right up. That's what this sounds like, isn't it? And so there's no earthly reason to convince this guy to let them eat just the vegetables with the promise that in 10 days they're going to look just fine. They're going to look healthy and robust and fat, right? So there's a measure here. There's a measure here of faith when he says this. Shockingly, this time, Daniel's fidelity to God was greeted with agreement from someone able to keep him from compromising his faith. Look at it there in verse 14. Don't let this event, this moment, be glossed over as just a simple nicety among in the story. This is somebody that had the power to help Daniel not be defiled say yes. Look at it. The steward listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. He agreed to it. There was no earthly reason for him to do so, right? He no doubt feared the king as well. And yet, God's grace moved in this man so that he would say yes. Let me just ask you. I just feel compelled to ask this question because I've been asking it of myself this week as I've been studying this text. Are you ashamed to take a stand against the immoral behavior that others expect of you? Do you remain silent when the Holy Spirit of God inside you is leading you to take a stand against sin? Are you discouraged at the slightest opposition when you speak out for God? Who knows what God would do if we would remain steadfast? If we would be persistent before powerful people who oppose our beliefs? If we would respectfully keep at it? I wonder what God would do. Once again, however, Daniel's stand had placed himself and his friends where calamity could strike. As I mentioned, when you make your stand for God, you've got crosshairs of the world on your forehead, little red dots all over you, right? As the scopes hit. If eating only vegetables causes them to look gaunt and sickly, the steward and perhaps even the chief of the eunuchs would certainly turn against them. At the very least, they'd only give them the king's food and wine. At the worst, perhaps they would be turned over to be punished. These young men stood against the king, trusting in God regardless of the outcome. This is what we see in this middle section of the narrative. And there's no guarantee that they will come out of it. And I want you to hear me, friends, brothers and sisters in Christ. When you make a stand for God, it doesn't always look like Daniel 1. Sometimes it looks like unjust suffering. Sometimes it looks like you lose your job. Sometimes it looks like you're blackballed in the family. Sometimes it looks like your friends hating you and disowning you. And that's the cost of being God's. But what we see in this text is an amazing conclusion of the events. We see it in verses 15 through 21, and we see that obstacles and threats are overruled. Despite powerful foes and certain failure of Daniel's decision, God's good plans for his people come to pass. They come to pass as they always do. Despite only eating vegetables for 10 days, the young men, according to verses 15 and 16, were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. That is ongoing for those 3 years. Amazing! Despite the fact that they said, we don't want the king's choice food, one translation has it. And what is sure to be his excellent wine, we'll just take vegetables and water. We are going to remain distinct. We are going to stay undefiled in this matter. There's no way. There's no way after 10 days. Have you ever gone without eating because you're sick for 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days? How many have been 10 days without eating anything substantial? Nobody after that amount of time looks healthy and fatter than other people. And yet, this is what the amazing results are of this. Friends, this is not a childhood fairy tale. These are real life events. These are God's people that took a stand, and this happened. This happened. Despite their lack of upbringing in Judah, rather in Babylon, and their unfamiliarity with this new language and literature and customs, at the end of their 3 years of training, sustained only by this paltry diet, this is the result, verses 19 and 20. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. Wow. How old were these? How old were these enchanters? How much experience in the custom and literature and language did these sorcerers have? How long had they studied the doctrine of the Babylonian gods? And yet Daniel and these other three were far superior in their understanding. Far superior in every way. 10 times better. Right? It's extraordinary that this is the result. Friends, there's no way this happens. We can take the brightest and the best among us. You know, well, let's take our young people, okay? Anybody that's Dakota's here today, so we'll take anybody that's 29 and younger, okay? And we'll give a standardized test, okay? In multiple areas. And we'll take the three brightest, and we'll send them for this training for 3 years. There's no way they're 10 times better than every magician and sorcerer in his kingdom. But yet, this is what happened. This is what happened to God's people who took a stand. Even though Nebuchadnezzar is portrayed as having great power in this chapter, God is the one who had been orchestrating all of the events. It's God that's always working in the background, even when we think there's no way I can stand for Him. The world's powers, the laws, the culture, it's too strong for me. In your struggle, God is always working in every one of those events. God gave Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar in the first place, in verse 1. Despite Nebuchadnezzar commanding everyone to force these youths to conform to Babylonian beliefs and to compromise their faith, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the eyes of his overseers, in verse 9 and verse 14. God made his faithful vegetarians to remain fat and healthy, as we just read. And God caused even Nebuchadnezzar himself to judge them as worthy of bringing them to counsel him in his court. In fact, the text concludes by telling us God would use Daniel in this way for more than 60 years. He would run through a number of kings that he would counsel. God's influence in the court of the enemy king. Friends, how incredible are God's plans? None would have predicted this. I know this is a familiar story, so you have to hear it fresh again today. But nobody would have predicted this result. The result, I mean, would have been snuffed out at first mention of, I don't really want the king's food. Oh, really? No one asked you what you wanted. You'll eat it, or we'll stuff it down your throat, or we'll cut your head off. That's how that would have went down. And if you would have duped somebody, right, just through your own machinations, into letting you try it for 10 days, there's no way you wouldn't have looked sickly. And that guy wouldn't have been afraid for his own life if he continued. And there's no way you would have so excelled in a culture and language and literature that you know nothing of that would have put you as the chief counselor of the king. And yet, this is God's plans. Daniel and his friends are portrayed as having unwavering faith here. Despite being exiles and strangers made to live in a foreign land, that they are described as being morally righteous and exemplary in every way. Did you see that? Look at verse 19. The chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. We're called to live like them. We're called to live after that pattern of faith. Peter tells us to be holy as God is holy. Hebrews tells us to live by faith as strangers here, knowing that we're citizens of heaven. This is the call to paddle upstream, friends. The current of this wicked world is so strong. The obstacles against our faithfulness are hard to navigate around, hard to get our footing. But who knows how God might employ us in this world? Perhaps we would even stand before judges and policymakers. Before, perhaps we would even be placed in prominent positions, so that God's kingdom might be expanded in ways we would have never fathomed. We're called to live like that. Though Daniel serves as an example, a powerful example of how we should live in this world, his role is actually much more significant than that. He serves here for us as a type of Christ. That is, one who prefigures him and predicts what his ministry will look like. Just like Daniel, the biblical record also described Jesus as having lived a perfect life of righteousness, an unwavering commitment to obey God's will no matter the cost. But in the case of the Savior, he would find no favorable treatment as he stood before the powerful of his day. Though finding no fault in him, Pilate would in fact give in to the demands to crucify him. This too was God's plan for the good of his people. And because he died in the place of sinners, those that will turn in faith to him, who have no business standing before the King of Kings, will be able to do so in the last day. And this is the vision of Daniel standing before the king. I trust you'll think through these things. I trust you'll think through the call to live holy in this life, not trusting in your own righteousness, but in his righteousness.